without getting too much into the technicalities of having put anthologies together, you know, some anthologies have, you know, will have maybe poems from 50 poets and one or two poems from each, and I think it can be a very confusing thing because there is no narrative then. You've just got this sort of mass of things. So I wanted to choose poets who had a certain body of work and who had thought about the war rather than just writing one-off poems. And I guess I was looking for those who... Each one of those poets tells the story of a journey, I think. And each one of them, I think, has that capacity to... Not just the fact they were directly involved and directly invested in what was happening, but they were able to describe that sort of experience without looking away or without, you know, softening things with fine words or false sentiments or false reassurances. I guess the exception to that was Rupert Brooke, and it's hard in an anthology, I think, to miss out Brooke because he was so influential on many of the soldier poets, less influential on others, but very influential on people like Graves, Sassoon. And of course, he wrote those poems which started the whole myth of the son of the soldier. You know, if I should die, you know, think only this of me. There's a corner of some foreign field that is forever England. And when he died on St. George's Day, Shakespeare's birthday, you know, it was read out in St. Paul's Cathedral by the Dean of St. Paul's, and this myth was created of this golden youth, you know, sacrificing itself for love of country. And I think that wasn't Brooke really, and he himself didn't have the moment. And again, he wrote that before he saw any action. He had seen, he'd been in Belgium for the retreat from Mons, and was shocked by seeing lots of refugees. But he never actually got to see any direct action. He died in the Aegean on his way to Gallipoli and died of blood poisoning. But I included in the anthology just a draft, so an unfinished poem, which I thought showed where it might be headed, his work. It describes being on the ship and looks through a window at soldiers playing cards and thinks what might be waiting for them. And you could see there was a more honest side to Brooke. And some people took Brooke as a great starting point. People like Charles Hamilton Sawley, he was another interesting figure, another great early loss, so we never really got, again, we only have his poems from his notebooks. But, you know, he said that Brooke was too worried about, too obsessed with his own self-sacrifice, you know. And he didn't trust him. And Sawley is somebody who was very clever, had travelled through, you know, although a young man, he spent his gap year travelling in Germany, was in Germany when war broke out, signed up, but with his eyes open, he wasn't part of that patriotic thing. He thought the war was a terrible thing. And I think his objectives in signing up are quite complex. And of course, what he criticises Brooke for is a sort of fine words, dressing things up with some sort of false sentiments and fine words, which gives a false sense of reassurance to the reader. And that's what many other younger poets wanted to rebel against. Finally, they were there was a phrase going around in the war, and May Wedderburn Cannon, who we talk about, she says there was a phrase going around that said, "I went to the war with Rupert Brooke and I came home with Siegfried Sassoon." You know, I went full of this idealism, this patriotism, this view of a golden youth giving itself for love of country, and came back cynical and disillusioned. Well, that journey from illusion to disillusion wasn't shared by everybody, and certainly not by May Wedderburn Cannon, who's one of the women I put in the anthology. And she, like a number of other people, like a number of other poets, She went to the war believing it was justified and the right thing to do, and she came home believing in it, and even though her fiancé died at the end of the war. So there were 15 poets in the anthology, and what I tried to do was to, as I said, follow the journey. I was interested in poets who I felt had taken themselves to probably the extreme edge of endurable experience. You know, things, it's hard to, you know, you can't really underestimate some of the horrors that they were all involved in, whatever role they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you think of war poetry, you know, the first thing is you must presumably wish it didn't exist, you know, because you wouldn't want to say we want to have war poetry, because the price of being a war poet is very high. But what interests me is how most of these are young people, not all of them. People like Lawrence Binyon was 43 when he went, but they go there, and there is, if you look at all the good poetry written about the war, you know, they were sent to the war to kill people, sent to the war to do a job, which meant defeating another army. But in their writing, it's impossible to discover any sort of sense of hatred. Instead, what becomes remarkable when you read it is the opposite. These are poems that are full of love and compassion and humanity. There are other things in there as well. There's fear, there's anger, there's despair. But I think it's remarkable that when when they found themselves under this sort of pressure that, you know, I find hard to imagine, that's what endured, that's what came out.
Mm.
And it's not that I've selected poems just to choose those ones that have got a sense of compassion and humanity in them. They're the ones that came out. They're the strongest poems. And I think that's one of the reasons we are drawn to this, because at the end there's no, it's about war, but there's no sense of hatred for the enemy. You know, I've given talks in all sorts of places on war poetry, and when you go abroad, they're a bit puzzled, because this is quite a British phenomenon. And I remember lecturing in China on war poetry, and they come along, I think they're thinking I'm going to talk about The Charge of the Light Brigade or something similar, you know, which is a fantastic poem. It's a fantastic piece of writing. But it's going to be heroic. It's going to be about bravery. It's going to be about the virtues of war. And then you read Wilfred Owen to them, and you can see them thinking, I've got to rethink this. This isn't what I was expecting. But I also find that they can be attracted to that, because these are universal experiences, in the sense that, you know, what do you do when you come under that sort of pressure? And I think it is remarkable that these poets have this enduring sense of humanity. And I think what was interesting was bringing the women into that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they do have a different voice and has been completely marginalised and written out of it. And so, for example, Vera Brittain, she's very well known for Testament of Youth, but the poems, I know on the surface they can seem slightly conventional, but I think just look under that a little bit, and that they, you know, there's some strong thinking going on there. So she's got this poem called The German Ward. So she was originally sent off to Malta when she was at Oxford. She was studying at Oxford. Volunteered as a nurse because she wanted to be with her brother and her boyfriend. Both went out to fight. Both died. But she wanted to play her part. So she volunteered as a nurse. She was sent to Malta, first of all, then asked to be transferred to France, and then was put in to probably the least popular nursing situation, which was to nurse German soldiers. And so she's got this remarkable poem, I think, about that moment. And these are the people who have killed her brother. These are the people who are killing her friends. And her job is to look after them and care for them. And she does. And she does care for them. And I think she discovers in herself then not only a new sense of herself, but a deeper sense of her own humanity. And that she's able to do that. And the other nurses, she admires the other nurses in the poem for having that, you know, that capacity to nurse the wounded, the wounded enemy, as she calls them. And I think that that brings in a voice that is quite different to the voice of, you know, which is so annoying to certain historians and certain politicians. You know, there are other narratives, is what I think I'm saying, rather than the one that has became quite dominant in the 1970s. Ferguson's right, it became dominant in the 70s. I said that very influential series of anthologies that came out in the 70s that made us all think that all world poetry is anti-war. Of course it isn't.
It seems to me to be as much a story then of endurance, of getting through it, rather than necessarily celebrating or critiquing it.
Yeah.
But I thought that that was a remarkable perspective on nursing, because I have to say I know very little about the experience of First World War nursing. I think as a society we think we do know about it,
yes,
because it's nursing.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
there's
right.
So much we don't understand.
There's a lot we don't understand about
history,
yeah.
That comes through quite strongly,
yes,
from experience.
Yes.
In those poems.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of the nurses out there were writing. There weren't very many professional nurses. There certainly weren't enough, so they had to rely on volunteers, and these volunteers tended to be middle class because they weren't paid, so they had to buy their own uniform, they had to pay for themselves to get there, had to be able to maintain themselves without pay, so it was a socially self-selecting group of people. And not surprisingly, they, like some of the young soldiers, they thought about what they did and wrote about it. Some turned to poetry, not all of them. And you know, one poet who I'm particularly interested in, Mary Borden, an American poet, she in 1915 she set up her own hospital in Wurzburger in Belgium. And I can't remember how many nurses there were there, but something like 25 nurses that she brought together, paid for herself. She's very wealthy. Four of them have written books about that hospital. Yeah.
Wow.
So they were a literary bunch too.
Yeah.
You know, and each of those four books is extremely good, I would say. But we don't know them.
Mm.
You know, they've been forgotten, those books. And the poetry that Borden wrote when she was there has been, you know, pretty largely forgotten until very recently.
Which brings us to our second, the anthology for the centre.
Mm. And the second anthology was actually Counterwave, which I call Poetry of Rescue in the First World War, because these are people who went to the front. They were on active service, but they didn't take a gun with them. Their job wasn't to kill people. It wasn't to take life, it was to save life.
So stretcher bearers.
They drove an ambulance. They were nurses. Hospital porters,
mm-hmm.
There were stretcher bearers, one was a chaplain. May Wedderburn Cannon worked in a canteen, as did Ernest Hemingway. So they all were there to, their response was, you know, there was a humanitarian crisis and they responded to it. Their motives for going, just like the soldiers who went were wide and various. You know, I think you'll find that poets like John Masefield, Lawrence Binyon, Mary Borden, Vera Brittain, they had a strong sense of duty and a strong sense of wanting to respond. Binyon had this phrase, the call and the answer. You know, the call was put out for help, and this was their response. They wanted to be, in Binyon's phrase, they wanted to be made use of in some way. And so they went to do different things. Other poets in the book, I think, went for other reasons. Unusually, it includes three American poets, Mary Borden herself, though she'd made her home in England by that time, but Ernest Hemingway and E.E. Cummings, not often thought of as war poets. But Hemingway and Cummings were both young men. I mean, Hemingway was 18. He was, when they were looking for adventure, I'm pretty sure, you know. And they thought it was going to give them a sense of adventure and something to write about. And they went off, I think, for slightly different reasons. But each of them, again, goes on a journey, and I think there's a similar sense of responding to direct witness, to, you know, and I say, you know, looking at the world they found themselves in, but not looking away, not flinching. There is a sense of being honest about what they saw and how they felt about it. And I think that's what we respond to now. And it's interesting to think that a number of the, you know, one of the accusations against war poetry has historically been that it's not very good poetry. Mm. Yeats, famously, when he did his 1936 anthology of modern poetry, excluded them because he said that the poetry isn't very good, and Owen was the worst. You know, he said it didn't deserve to appear in a local newspaper, Owen's poetry. I think we're rather different now. So the work of Mary Borden, a lot of it was never published in her lifetime. The same for you know, a number of other poets. They didn't, you know, like Owen and Rosenberg. They didn't Sawley. They didn't get to the point where they could revise and polish and things. And so they, but I think as a society, we've got rather used to art that is maybe not highly crafted. And you know, it's certainly true in the visual arts and the plastic arts that, you know, we're looking for something else. We're looking for an ability to connect with, I think, an authenticity of intent, certain ideas that resonate, a certain honesty of emotion. And we value these highly, and in some cases perhaps more than the skill of the hand, the skill of the versifier. And so you know that's what we're responding to. And if all of the I think that's why we don't like Rupert Brooke anymore. You know, I mean, those are perfectly crafted sonnets he wrote. But if you're like Mary Borden, and you know, she was doing 24-hour shifts in the hospital, you know, surviving on 2 or 3 hours a night's sleep, dealing with hundreds of patients dying every day in her hands. If she was sitting down between those shifts and writing these perfectly crafted sonnets about all of that, I think we might distrust it in some way. We might think it's too manipulated. It's an artificial response. So her work in particular, it just comes out like a stream of consciousness. She just seems to sort of knock it out. And
I was looking particularly, and it's interesting you talked about authenticity and how we search for it as a way of making a connection, because Come to Me Quickly was the one that I've very much responded
extraordinary,
to.
Extraordinary, yeah.
Which, because mainly because it's firstly it's an experience or a feeling about nursing that you don't expect. You know, come to me quickly and take me away from my wounded men. I cannot bear their pain anymore. Come quickly and take me away out of this place. Give me rest. Which is, I mean, those words, you don't expect them as
yeah.
part of the narrative of
yeah.
First World War Nursing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that image of, oh, rest now.
Yes, absolutely. Of yes, of this sort of angelic
yes.
Carer. Absolutely
but
right.
But it reminded me, and I talked to one of our teacher fellows about this, it really reminded me of motherhood. Because I am suffocating. I know it's terrible.
Yes, yes, yes.
I am
yeah.
suffocating. I cannot get away. They cling to my skirts, my arms. You know, if anybody's been looking after a toddler with teeth problems,
yes.
I don't want to minimise the experience
she's talking
about,
yes.
but it's that sense of that you're constantly being grabbed and, you know, the sensuality of somebody's hand always reaching for yours.
Yeah.
Of touching yours,
yes.
of pulling you,
yeah.
of demanding your attention, of their need that you have to place before your own.
Yeah,
I thought that was an astonishing.
Yeah, it is a remarkable poem, isn't it? Again, that
yeah.
she never published that. It's just her notes, and it's not even punctuated.
No,
she's got all these dashes in. I think probably thinking of Emily Dickinson in that, but.
And I think that
it just pours out of her somehow.
Yes.
That's what she felt. I don't think when you read that, I don't think. That's really, you don't doubt that's what she felt.
No.
And I think that's something that we do respond to. She goes on in that. She says, their wounds gape at me, their stumps menace me, their bandaged faces grimace at me, their death rattle curses me.
Mm.
Give me rest, make me clean. I am stained, I am soiled, I am streaked with their blood. I am soaked with the odour of the oozing of their wounds. I am saturated with the poison of their poor festering wounds. I am poisoned. I'm infected. I shall never wash it off. That's pretty intense stuff, but it comes from a pretty intense experience, I would say. The other thing that's interesting about Mary Borden is interesting. Some of the male poets, someone like Julian Grenfell wrote Into Battle, a famous poem. There's a sense of going to the war and putting on his uniform and fighting for his country enhances his sense of masculinity. He seems to be more of a man for being there, you know. Whereas Mary Borden, clearly in some of the poems and some of her stories, feels that her whole sense of being a woman, her whole sense of femininity has been undermined. And so she's got one poem. She says, "No, no, there is some sinister mistake. You cannot love me now. I am no more a thing to touch, a pleasant thing to take into one's arms. How can a man adore a woman with black blood upon her face, a cap of horror on her pallid head, mirrors of madness in the sunken place of eyes, hands dripping with the slimy dead?" And she says, "Go, leave me to the hungry lust of monstrous pain. I am his mistress now. These are the frantic beds of his delight." So there's a sense of, a whole sense of who she was has been questioned by this.
Mm.